This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
Keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. It's me again, Gary Clinton, with show 91 of Night Transmissions. We're going to start off with an episode from Escape, a CBS radio program that ran from 1947 until 1954, and really dealt with a wide variety of stories, including science fiction, horror, murder. The episode today is an adaptation of a short story by Irving S. Cobb, Snake Doctor. It's a story about jealousy, superstitions, and the occasional water moccasin. The story tonight is from August the 18th of 1949.
You are standing at the doorway of a cabin on Cashier Creek. Upon the ridge, the bloodhounds have caught your scent, and between you and a fortune, between you and escape, yawn the white jaws of a deadly cottonmouth.
We offer you Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Tonight, we escape to the worn-out acres of a poor farm somewhere in the southern mountains with Irvin S. Cobb's great tale of vengeance, Snake Doctor.
Far back in the southern mountains, it's quiet and hot and lonely. One pine-scarred hill is very much like the next, and one winding creek differs little from another. The area through which Cashier Creek twisted was the same as all the rest, except for the snakes. Deadly, venomous, cottonmouth moccasins. There are probably more snakes along Cashier Creek than anywhere else. Most people lived in constant deadly fear of these snakes, but there was one man who even seemed to like them. A man they called Snake Doctor. His cabin was near the creek bottom where the cottonmouths were the commonest, and he earned his meager living by rendering down their soft fats, bottling the oil, and selling it. Snake Doctor seemed harmless enough, but there was one man who believed he was a colleague of the devil, who hated him, because he wasn't afraid of the snakes. This man was Jafe Mourner, the Snake Doctor's nearest neighbor. Jafe was that dangerous kind of man who suspected, feared, and hated anything he didn't understand. And he understood neither cottonmouths nor the Snake Doctor. Jafe was ornery, ignorant, and shiftless. He'd rather shoot squirrels than chop cotton. He'd rather fish than hoe corn. And that's what he's doing now. Fishing down at the big hole with his son and heir, Finney, who's old enough, but not quite bright enough to handle a gun.
Missed him, dog.
Finney, you blame fool. I told you not to touch my gun.
Trump on him, far before he gets in the creek.
What?
The cottonmouth.
What?
Trump on him in front of you.
Cottonmouth. Vomit. Unearthly vomit.
You got it, Paul. Keep your foot on him. We'll stop at your stick.
You don't need to, son. He's dead. Now come here.
Paul, how'd he hit anything with that rifle? I had a bead draw right on him, and
you darn fool!
Do that for Paul.
Stirring up that filthy snake whilst I'm a-fishing.
Heck, he was sunning himself not more than 2 feet from you. He was just 2 feet from
Never mind that kind of talk. Won't be no fish around here till thunderation after all that racket. Well, Come on, let's go home and get us some vittles.
Jafe Mourner tossed his bait can into the creek and threw a stick after it. He stood there watching the stick drift slowly toward the big hole where the creek widened behind a jam of driftwood. Jafe watched as the eddy caught the stick and sucked it beneath the dam.
Come on, Bob.
Jafe was curious. He moved downstream a rod or two and waited, watching the water boil up from under the driftwood. But the stick didn't come up. That was strange. It must have caught under there in a tangle of water-soaked and sunken logs. Probably it'd stay there for months. Perhaps stay there always.
Let's get some vittles, Paul.
Jafe thought about this, and an idea began to form in his slow mind as he and Finney started for home.
How much oil you reckon's in this, and Paul? Daddy?
What you jawing about?
This old cotton man. How much oil you reckon's
in... Throw it down.
Throw it down? Why for? I'm gonna...
Throw it down like I say.
Oh? I was aiming on rendering the old cottonmouth spat like the snake doctor does. I was gonna sell it and make myself some money.
I don't like the squirming things around me.
But it's dead.
Leave it where it dropped.
You scared on cottonmouths, Paul?
I know better than to get myself bit by them.
Dick Bailey knowed a fella got himself bit once. Wearing a drop of liquor for miles. So he goes to work and he cuts open a live chicken. And he put on his leg where the bite was. Fella lived, too. Reckon Mr. Rives ever gets himself bit? I mean, handling cottonmouth like he does?
Who?
Mr. Rives.
Who?
Mr. Rives. That's old Snake Doctor's real name. Ma says I oughtn't call him Snake Doctor.
Never mind what your ma says. Nobody in my family's calling no snake-loving scum Mr. Rives.
Heck, that's what I say.
All right.
Could have made myself some money renting that cottonmouth fat down in the oil. How much you reckon old Snake Doctor makes out in oil he sells?
I don't know.
Tip Bailey says old Snake Doctor's got more than $1,000 hid away somewheres in his cabin.
More than that, most likely. Cussed old miser don't spend nothing. Ain't got nothing save that rack of bones mare of his.
Tip Bailey says whenever old Snake Doctor sets foot out in his place, he's got the granddaddy of all cottonmouths that he leaves out in the cabin to stand guard over his money. Yeah. Tip Bailey says he'd see old Snake Doctor put him in his pocket. Live ones, too.
Snake Doctor ain't fitting to be live himself.
Ma says he ain't so bad. Says he don't mean nobody harm.
Your ma better be careful who she's associating with.
She says he just don't have good sense. Had the fever too much. Daddy, you ever been in Snake Doctor's place?
I don't have nothing more than I have to do with that snake-loving hoodoo.
Dip Bailey says he'd bet it wouldn't be no task at all for some no good to poke around the Snake Doctor's shack and maybe find all the money and make off with it. Blame son's dirty rendering me down. Look at my head. Full of sweat. Look, Daddy. See? Full of sweat. Darn near guard full of sweat come off. Why turn it down that way, Paul? It's coming on noon. Dinner be most ready.
I'm going to tell the snake-loving hoodoo that there's some of them cottonmouths on the creek side of our deadening.
Heck, he knows that.
I'm going to tell him he's got my leave to catch him. You don't need to come along.
Well, if you're going over to his place, I'd... kind of like to see it for my own sake. Go on in, Paul. He ain't at home. Else why is he to show himself by now?
I reckon.
Can you see any snakes?
I told you to keep an eye out for
it. I bet it's in one of them chinks, Paul. Paul, I bet the money's in one of them...
I ain't looking for no money. Must be a dang snake itself, living in a place like this.
I know you ain't looking for any money, Paul, but if and you was, wouldn't you look at that there chink right up there?
Where?
Right there, second log above the fireplace on the right. You see that there hole?
Yeah. Yeah, I reckon I would look up there.
Since we're here...
I might as well see for myself.
Paul, I wouldn't be a mite surprised if old Snake Doctor had him...
Paw,
was you looking for something, Jake Marner?
Snake doctor.
Yeah. I was looking for you.
I want here.
Yeah. Look here, you old hoodoo. What's the idea of sneaking up on folks who's took the trouble to come all the way down here to do you a favor, huh? Come on, Finny. We're getting out of here.
Yes, sir. Like as not, they had a dang old moccasin squirching around in his pocket whilst he was talking to you. Daddy, do you mind how his eyes was when he come in? Do you mind how he kept looking up at the wall where I said I bet he had the money between the chinks?
Finny.
What?
Don't you say nothing to your ma about us being at the snake doctor's place, you understand?
Why, sure.
Well, just don't. And don't you go nigh it again. Cuss old varmint. You'd have thought we was prowlers way acting.
Yeah, prowlers. Ma? Stand about ready.
Your Paul with you, son?
Yeah. I got time enough for dinner to go down the spring and get Mr. Cowart.
If you stir your stumps, you can. Catch anything, Jeep?
How you think I can catch fish with Fetty fine off my gun at cotton mouths all the time?
Ain't this heat more than a body can bear? Ain't it colder but the creek? That poor old Miss Rives come by here a spell ago. Might nigh shook to pieces with a chill.
Oh. He come by, did he? Well, did he come in?
Just for a minute.
Just for a minute, eh? What'd he want?
He wanted could have given something for his ailment. Just about could drag one soft foot afore the other. Barely could make it up here from his place. I give him a dose out in our butler's acre drops. Would have given him a little smidge of liquor, only
oh,
I could...
Oh, you would, huh?
Please don't, Jeff. Don't whop me. Don't, Jeff, don't whop me. Just poor old Mr. Ives.
Mr. Ives. Mr. Ives. How many times I gotta tell you that old hoodoo's name is Snake Doctor?
You don't mean nobody no harm.
He aimed me to skin a loss for its hide and tallow, and you calling him Mr. Ives. Huh. You be calling him honey and sugar next. With that, I lawn you.
Please, Jay, please.
Bad names, huh? Well, I aim to lawn you. What's his name now? Well, what's your poor Mr. Rives' name now?
Snake Doctor.
Kizzy Mourner rubbed the ugly red weld on her scrawny arm and gave the frying pan full of sizzling side meat a hopeless nudge. She prayed that time and food might take the edge off Jafe's temper. Finny slouched in from the spring, saw the mark on her arm.
Pa been whomping you again, Ma? What'd you do this time?
She silently dished up the hogback and cornbread for her two men. While they sat at table, she ate on her feet, serving them between bites, as was the custom in the Mourner household. After dinner, Finny stretched out under the chinaberry tree. Kizzy sat on the porch, fanning herself and dipping snuff with a peach twig, scouring it back and forth on her gums. Jafe took his ease on the floor of the back room, but he didn't sleep. The meanness was stirring in him, and his hatred of the man he couldn't understand, the man who'd got rich off of cottonmouths. His mind was working on something he'd seen that day and another thing he'd heard. He was adding them together. That stick could have disappeared under the log jam, and the snake doctor's money. It was 4 o'clock before any of them moved, and then Jafe spoke to his wife for the first time since noon.
Busy? Where's that there vial of drinking liquor?
By the window. You took it out in your pocket before you laid down.
I ought to carry a vial of liquor with me. I might get bit by a moccasin as soon as Paul would.
You better not let me catch you. You find it, Jay?
I just remembered. I won't be needing to tote no spits along with me while I'm going.
I wouldn't take no chance, Dave. Just one cottonmouth bite.
Cottonmouth's all down the slashes, else along a creek. Well, I'll be all this evening's up along Bailey's Ridge in the high ground.
You fixing to go shooting?
Yeah. Ain't a gummy chance of young squirrels fixing on dust time. Heard them barking all around me this morning.
Reckon I'll come along, Paul.
You stay in here, son.
Oh, dang it. It'll be steaming in the place when the rain comes down. Paul, you might be needing me just...
You stay here.
Oh, dang.
Kitty, you set me up a snack of cold supper on the chef. Barclay, I won't get back till it's plumb dark.
In just a moment, we'll return to the second act of Escape. But first, that wonderful variety show with a purpose, CBS's one-hour-long program, This Is Broadway, will be round again tomorrow night on most of these same stations. Comedian Abe Burrows, Broadway playwright George S. Kaufman, Master of Ceremonies Clifton Fadiman will all be here, playing host to the top stars of show business. Hear these top stars and their top acts. Then listen closely as the expert showmen on This Is Broadway help them with show business problems. And now, we return to the second act of Escape, and tonight's story, Snake Doctor.
Jafe Morn had turned north through his struggling cornrows, and in a minute he was lost from sight. He kept on for nearly a mile till he came to a wild red mulberry tree. Where there are mulberries, there are bound to be squirrels. Very neatly, he shot two young greys right through the head. But Jafe was a master marksman. And unsuspected by any who knew him, Jafe had another quality, one that made him more dangerous than the rest of his kind. Jafe had an imagination. Today it was in excellent working order. He tied the brain squirrels together and swung them over his shoulder. If needed, they'd be his alibi. And then he sat down under a tree for a while.
Got plenty of time. Don't need to get down to Snake Doctor's place till about dusk. When he comes out to feed that swayback mare of his. Mr. Ryan.
He sat out two brisk thunder showers in the intervals between them. And then he set off in a wide arc down Bailey's Branch along the skirts of Little Cypress Slash down to the sunken flats edge in Cashier Creek. It took more than an hour of careful traveling before he came to his destination. A screen of haw bushes, less than 50 yards behind the Snake Doctor's cabin.
No matter how ailing he is, you get up and come out to feed that rack of bones mare. Mr. Rhymes. Well, I'll learn him to go colleaguing around another man's woman.
Jafe Morner let his jealousy heat him to white hatred. At this moment, he was avenging his honor. Didn't admit even to himself that the real reason he was here was his Snake Doctor's money, hidden behind the log by the fireplace.
Home-wrecking, snake-loving varmint. Well, 10 minutes from now, I'll chunk him down a big hole in a creek like I did that stick this morning. And he'll go down and never come up. And nobody'll miss him. Nobody will know he's gone for leastwise a week, maybe a month. And maybe if I get around to it, I might come back his way someday. Poke around that cabin of his'n, just to see if it's true, his having all that money hid away.
Jafe Morner's speculations were cut short. The cabin door opened and a figure stepped out into the growing dusk and walked toward the stable. He saw the Snake Doctor's loppy old straw hat and his dark coat drawn over a pit. At this distance, he couldn't miss. And he didn't. The figure jerked backward and then went face forward. Jafe started for him, then he stopped. His eyes bugged. His mouth formed a scream that he couldn't utter. His rifle dropped to the ground. He had just killed a Snake Doctor. Killed him dead with a .32 caliber slug through the head. And there on his door still stood Snake Doctor, whole and sound, staring at him.
Dave Marner, what have you done?
The scream came at last, for Jafe Mourner had seen the devil, the snake doctor who arose alive from his bullet-riddled body. Jafe whirled and ran into the deep darkening woods, whimpering like a whipped puppy as he tore through the brush. Escape. He must escape this thing. He must get under the shelter of a sound roof. He must have the protection of four walls around him. He ran and ran for hours. It was close to midnight when he came out on a dirt road a short distance southeast of his own land. Beyond the next bend, he'd be in sight of home. And then he stopped. Around the bend, coming toward him, was a joggling light, a lantern hanging on a buggy. Jake flattened himself in a clump of brush to hide until the traveler passed. And then, just as the rig was opposite him, he heard a call coming from the other direction.
Who's jogging?
Oh, there. Oh, skinny boy. Me, Davis Ware. That you, Tip Bailey?
Yep. Hoofed it out from the junction. Tolerable tired. What brings you out this time of night, Davis? Somebody sick?
Sick nothing. There's been a parcel of trouble popping in these bottoms tonight. Steady, boy. Steady.
What do you mean?
A killing. That's what I mean.
You don't say. Who got killed?
My fixing to tell you. It happened just around dusk time at down at old snake doctor's place.
Yeah? Was it him was killed?
Give me time, Tip. It seems like snake doctor's been a-chillin' lately.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty bad off today, so Miss Kizzy Mourner, she footed it down from her place to his'n, fetching some physic with her and a plate of hot victuals.
You might have thought it, Miss Mourner, might have thought it.
You want to hear this?
Yeah. Go on.
Oh, boy. Well, pretty soon after she got there, it seemed like he was tired. And he tried to get up out of his bed to go and feed that old crowbait nag of his'n.
Uh-huh.
It started in again by then, pouring down hard. So she made him stay where he was, and she put on his old hat and throwed his old coat around her. And he wanted to keep out of the wet. And no more, and she got outside, and a shot came from the edge of the woods, and down she went with a bullet through her brains.
Killed her?
Kizzy.
It was a dog.
It was Kizzy.
But who done it?
That low-flung husband of hers done it, that's who.
They thought it was him.
Sure thing. Oh, boy. Sure thing, they're certain. Snake doctor jumped up when he heard the shot, and he catched a quick look at Jafe over the fence.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a long streak in Kiz's arm, where he must have whopped her during the day.
Why, hanging's a sight too good. Did they catch him?
No, but they gonna.
Sheriff get there yet?
No, but he's due any minute with his pack of hound dogs.
Oh.
Trail ought to lay good. Ground being damp the way it is.
Oh, sure.
Old snake doctor, he's a-saying the Lord's going to strike the murder down in his track.
Amen.
But me, I'm a-putting my main dependence on them bloodhounds.
Oh, poor Miss Marner. She always was a good-hearted, hard-working woman.
Kizzy.
And mightily put
she's
upon
dead.
By that skunk.
I shot Kizzy.
Say, did you hear something just then?
Say, I did.
Oh, probably a rabbit breaking through the brush. Hmm?
Listen.
Yeah?
The sheriffs are coming.
Oh, yeah.
Can you hear them hounds of his'n?
Oh, just for sure.
I gotta hurry. Get out, Bessie. Come on.
I'll see you back at the morning.
You sure will.
Jafe didn't waste no time mourning his dead wife. He had a chance against a pack of bloodhounds if he started right away. But Jake's imagination went to work again as he backtracked along the creek bottom in the spotty moonlight.
Gotta throw those dogs off the trail. He got away to creek. Even if it is full of cotton mounds. Must be all around me now. Folks say don't strike in the water. Hope them folks is right. I've got to get back to the snake doctor's. Get his money while he's still up at my place with Kiz's remains. Get his money and the rest will be easy. I'll make for the deep timber, cross country to the river, make it by tomorrow sundown. Hire me a shanty boater to ferry me to the Arkansas side. He'll get me a haircut and catch me a train for somewhere else. And I got to get snake doctor's money first.
Snake Doctor's cabin was dark and empty when Jafe reached it. Only a few dull embers in the fireplace. But he knew where the chink was. He'd find it in the dark. He scrabbled the logs, felt some bark give, felt the clay mortar crumble under his fingernails. There it was, a hole big enough for a man's arm. He plunged his hand into it, touched something slick and smooth, and then something sharp plunged into his thumb. At that moment, the fire flickered to life. Jafe yanked his hand out of the hole, saw two tiny bleeding punctures in his thumb. At the mouth of the hole stretched the wide-open jaws of a cottonmouth. It worked fast. He felt the pain leaping from his thumb to his hand, seeping up his arm. If only he had some liquor. If he had a fresh-killed chicken to slap on the wound, but he had nothing. Then a sharp, horrible pain wrenched his heart, and then a second. And there in the firelight, the huge cottonmouth poised in its crevice. Jafe leaped out of the shack, started blinded for the timber. He staggered, stumbled, then he pitched forward on his face, his open mouth full of weeds and muddy grass stems. The cramping fingers of his outstretched right hand almost touched a reddish-black smear on the wet, trampled grass.
Riddance by gravy. I'd call it that, wouldn't you, Doc?
I reckon there's a sort of rough justice in the way he died. Look, his hand reaching out, just about touching the blood where his woman fell. But in all my life, I've never known but two or three people actually was bitten by water moccasins. And until tonight, I've never had personal knowledge of anybody dying from the bite of any kind of snake.
It's a fact.
You know that, crazy. I'm gonna take that rifle off of you, Penny Mourner.
I'm gonna kill the dang reptile that killed my paw.
That Mourner's boy kicking up the fuss?
Yep, and no good like his paw.
Let go of me. I'm my own boss, man.
What's the trouble, Tip?
Penny hairs went out in his hay.
I'm gonna kill the snake that bit in my paw. Then I'm gonna give that snake doctor a whomping for keeping a reptile in this place.
Your pa got what was his due, Finney. Snake doctor ain't to blame.
He's a hoodoo devil.
Look here, boy. Mr. Rives give me all his savings, nearly $100, to pay for burying your mother decent. That's how much he thought of her. Now go on home. Behave yourself.
I'm gonna get
go it. On, Finney. There ain't no reason for you hanging around here.
Somebody ought to kill a reptile a bit in my paw.
Doc, just a minute ago you started to say something about snake bite not killing. But how about them two marks on his thumb? Them snakes' gashes like some I've seen.
No, that don't explain how it...
It's Finney Mourner. He's in the cabin.
The fool kid. Come on, Doc. He's probably shot.
Well, we're too far
off. I shot it! But I just hit it! It's gonna get me like he got my paw!
He said he shot at something in the cabin. Come on, Doc. Let's go see.
All right, we'll I don't see anything.
Oh, Finney's had enough happened to him yesterday and today to upset even a bright boy. So we can't... Oh. There it is.
What?
That cotton mouth up there in that hole in the log.
Oh, that. Snake doctor told me about that varmint. Look at him closer, David.
No, sir. Not me.
Go ahead. It's just a stuffed snake.
Stuffed?
Mm-hmm. Snake doctor believes in precautions because that hole's where he hides his money. That snake would scare away anybody who didn't know it was stuffed. But just to be sure, old snake doctor lined the hole with coils of barbed wire.
Oh, I see. You mean them marks on Jafe's thumb was got off the barbed wire?
That's right, sir. Lots stronger hearts than Jafe Mourner's would stop beating at a scare like that.
Well, I'll be switched. Old snake doctor's a cute one, ain't he?
Escape, produced and directed by Norman McDonald, tonight brought you Snake Doctor by Irvin S. Cobb, adapted for radio by Fred Howard, starring Bill Conrad as Jafe with Paul Frees as Finney. Featured in the cast were Ira Grossell as the narrator, Bill Lally, Ruth Parrott, Wilms Herbert, and Edgar Barrier. Music is conducted by Wilbur Hatch. This is John Jacobs speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Oh, okay. We're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
Stories of human beings who, by a wave of a magic wand, are transformed into animals are an inevitable part of the literature of our childhood. But now and then, we come upon an incident which makes us pause and wonder whether our childish imaginings are quite as childish as they seem.
Miss Olive Clark, who was, for 20 years, the principal of the Girls' National School at Whittlesey, was not a stern disciplinarian. But one thing she did insist on was strict observance of the curfew. Consequently, when at 12:30 on a certain night in the year 1911, she saw a shaft of light still gleaming beneath the door of Janet Seaton's room, she decided to investigate.
Oh, hello there, Miss Clark.
Janet, do you realize what time it is? Your light should have been out over 2 hours ago.
Oh, but I couldn't help it. I've been reading this book, and I forgot all about time. There's a little boy in it, and he turns into a bird, and he flies all over the world.
That's enough, Janet. You shouldn't be reading such childish nonsense.
But you see, Miss Clark, I believe in things like that. I'm quite sure that lots of birds and animals are really the souls of dead people in disguise.
It was almost a week later that Miss Clark found on her office desk a message from Janet Seaton, asking her to come to the dormitory at her earliest convenience.
Miss Clark, will you tell me something, please? Did anybody, any girl who used to go to school here, ever die in this room?
Well, now that you ask, yes.
I thought so.
Why?
Because she's come back. There she is, over there in the corner.
Miss Clark wheeled around and stared at the spot where Janet was pointing. There, at the juncture of two walls, a large red butterfly was clinging.
She was there when I came in last night. I don't know how she got in. The door and the windows were closed.
For more than a month, the butterfly remained in precisely the same spot. And nothing could convince Janet Seaton that it was not a reincarnation of the girl who had died. And then, late in the spring, they found its lifeless body on the floor.
Just because she died doesn't prove anything. Her soul probably passed to another animal of some sort. She'll be back.
In the summer of that year, Janet Seaton graduated from the Girls' National. And for 16 years thereafter, no one connected with the school heard from her. And then, on a morning in March 1927, she came back and dropped into Miss Clark's office and began to reminisce about her childhood experience.
Remember what a silly little fool I was, Miss Clark. I insisted that poor old butterfly was the soul of a dead girl. Janet, there's still a butterfly in your room. Every spring, at just about the same time, one has appeared in the same corner for 16 years. There's one up there now.
There is no need to accept the interpretation which Janet Seaton offered for this strange story when she was a child. And yet, even after we have rejected it, the facts are that a red admiral butterfly did reappear each year in the same corner of the same room, and that it remained there until its death. And these facts are, in themselves, incredible but true.
Up next is a visit with our friend Raymond in his inner sanctum from April the 15th of 1944. The Skull That Walks.
Good evening, friends of the inner sanctum. This is Raymond, your host. Well, come in, won't you? Yes, how are your spirits this evening?
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Our spirits are fine, too. Would you like to see them?
Oh, it's no trouble at all.
Now, which would you care to see first, the spirit or the body? Ah, well, the body is right over there on the floor, and the spirit is right next to it.
Oh, you can't see it. I forgot to tell you, you have to be one in order to see one.
Shall we get started?
Well, naturally.
Now, turn out the lights.
No, no, you won't see any ghosts in the dark, but they'll be able to see you.
Far from town, there are a group of three hills. On the summit of the highest of them is the Cruz estate, owned by two brothers, Arthur and Carl. At this moment, Carl and his wife, Lucille, are digging a hole at the entrance of the estate, planting young poplar trees.
I think it's deep enough.
Oh, I think we ought to go a little deeper down.
Oh, here comes Bill.
You're digging?
Yes, we're going to plant a whole row of Lombardy poplars.
Mm-hmm. You mean right here?
Yep. We're going to line both sides of the road.
Well, perhaps you'd better let me do it. I'm your caretaker. I should do the garden.
Bill, do look upset. What's the matter?
Well, where you're digging is an old Indian burial spot. There's a curse on it.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Bill, you don't believe it?
Of course not. Lucille and I don't go in for superstition.
Yes, but it's no superstition, sir. It's
You hit a rock.
Uh-huh. Oh, that sounds like a rock. A little hollow.
Dig it up, whatever it is.
It's a skull.
Yeah. Skull. Spears is right. But it must have been an old Indian burial ground.
Please put it back.
Oh, keep it.
Carl. Perhaps you'd better put it back.
No. Please, please bury it again, Mr. Cruz. It will bring bad luck to all of us.
No, Spears, that's just a silly superstition.
Well, what about the rest of the skeleton?
Well, there doesn't seem to be one. No, just a skull.
You bring it into the house, will you, Spears?
Little partner, I'd rather not.
All right, I'll take it in myself. Don't either of you mention this to my brother, Arthur. He's terribly scared of things like this. He's just gotten over his nervous breakdown.
Carl, perhaps you should put the skull back.
Why, Lucille, you're not being taken in by this hokum about curses, are you?
That sounded like my wife, Mary. She was cleaning the windows.
Good heavens. She fell out of the window.
Mary. Well, she's unconscious. Please do something. You must do something.
I'm afraid there's nothing we can do, Spears. He hit her head against a rock. She's dead.
How's Bill?
He's quieted down.
I can't understand it. There's only one rock underneath the window, and Mary hit that. That one rock. There isn't even a pebble around for yards.
Well, don't go imagining things again, Arthur.
Spears kept talking about a curse.
Spears believes in pixies and gremlins, too, don't forget.
Well, I feel rather funny about it all.
Oh, Carl, maybe you'd better switch some more lamps on. This living room feels gloomy.
Oh, let's cut this nonsense out.
Wait. You hear anything?
Oh? A dog?
Yes. Something's coming from the ceiling.
What's coming from the ceiling? I don't hear...
What is it?
What? It must be the beam. I sometimes do that from the heat.
It's not the beams. It's too regular a sound.
What room is directly above us?
It's an old bedroom. We use it as a storeroom now. It hasn't been opened in years.
Something up there.
Well, of course there is. A lot of old things from years back.
Did you put the skull in the skull door?
Yes, I did. What are you two whispering of? It's coming down the stairs.
We'll take a look at settlement. So far...
Look! At your feet, Carl. The skull. How did it get down here? It came down the steps.
Seems to be looking up there.
A skull. How did it get into the house?
Carl found it while digging. Spears said it belonged to some Indian.
Spears was right. There is a curse on the house. We'll all be killed. I'm leaving. I can't stand it.
Well, Carl, what are you going to do with the skull?
Well, lock it up in the closet. Lock it.
Carl, you'd better bury it again.
No, I can't do that, Lucille. If I do, it means I believe in all this tommy rot about ghosts.
Well, then suppose you tell me how a skull could open a door and then come bouncing down the steps.
don't know. Maybe someone's playing a trick on us.
What happened to Mary was no trick, Carl. Nor is this, and you know it.
Well, whatever it is, I'm not going to bury it. We'll keep it locked up in the closet.
Oh, Mr. Cruz.
Yes. What is it, sir?
Well, it isn't my place to tell you, sir, but I...
You're referring to the skull, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Well, it won't bother us anymore. The whole thing's some queer trick. I've got it safely hidden in this closet. I'm putting a lock on the outside.
But the lock isn't going to do any good, sir. It will break through the door, just like the last time.
I don't think anything like that can happen again. I'm the only one that has a key to this lock. If the skull was to break out, it'd have to come to me for the key. How are you feeling, Arthur?
I'll never feel right in this house again.
Oh, nonsense. Why don't you put a light on? Arthur, it's morbid sitting here in the dark by yourself. We're all going to die. Don't be ridiculous, Arthur.
Where is the skull?
Well, it can't get out. Tomorrow I'll take it into town and let the police look at it.
Tomorrow will be too late.
But I'm getting tired of this.
You've got to get hold of yourself, Arthur. You'll go completely to pieces.
You think I'm a coward, don't you? Oh, Arthur, no. You're not a coward. You're just a victim of your own exaggerated imagination.
Wait. There's someone at the door.
I'll open it.
Who is it?
I don't know. No one came in.
Something came in. For heaven's sake, put the light on.
The skull. I can't believe it.
You can't believe it. There it is, grinning at you from the floor, but you can't believe it. You don't believe in these things.
I put a lock on the door.
Locks aren't going to help.
What are you going to help? We're all going to die.
It's an hour later now. Arthur has gotten over his hysteria, but he's still terrified.
I'm not going to spend another night in this house, Carl.
But Arthur, there's got to be some logical explanation.
I'm not in the least bit curious. I just want to get out of here tonight.
I'm going to go with him, Carl.
Lucille. Well, perhaps we'll bury it again. We'll put it back in the same place we found.
That won't do any good. It's too late now.
Don't be ridiculous. If it wants anything at all, it wants to get buried again. I'm sure all this mysterious business will come to an end as soon as we bury it.
The house won't ever be the same.
Oh, stop it. Both of you. You're acting like a couple of scared children. We'll put the skull back where we found it, and we won't be bothered by it anymore. Spears! Spears!
Yes, Mr. Cruz.
This skull. Let's take it out, bury it, in the same place where we found it.
I'm glad you reconsidered, sir. It's the only way.
I don't seem to remember the spot.
Well, it's on the other side, sir, right near the entrance road.
Oh, yes.
Yes, sir. Here it is.
Yes. But the hole was dug. It's not here.
I filled it in, sir.
Oh, well, we'd better dig it up.
Yes, sir.
If you'll hold the skull, I'll dig it open. We might as well do it right. I know exactly how deep it was.
If you don't mind, Mr. Cruz, I'd rather not touch the skull.
All right. Yeah, that's about right. There. I'll put the thing back.
But it doesn't seem to want to go back.
No, I just missed dropping it into the hole. Hold the fire side down here.
Yes.
Well, that does it.
Oh, I hope we'll have no more trouble.
Well, Carl, did you bury it?
Yes, same place.
That's all. Forget about it, shall we?
Maybe it's easy for you, Carl. But I won't forget about it for a long time.
Neither will I. I'll be having nightmares about it for months.
I don't know what's gotten into you, Lucille. You were never easily frightened.
I'm not. But skulls that roll by themselves give me a funny feeling.
Mm. Well, look, come on, let's play cards. Huh? Cards? We don't need more than three hands to play. We'll forget the whole crazy business, huh? Okay?
I might as well.
All right, steal the card.
Okay. Well... Well, we're getting back to normalcy, huh?
Arthur, that's your card.
That wind came up suddenly.
Who's first?
You are.
Oh, all right. None done.
You're gone. Come on, Arthur, throw a card.
I think I hear something.
Of course you do. The wind.
No, I thought I heard a rapping sound.
Look, just pay attention to the game and stop listening for sound.
Here's my card.
You threw a club down on me for suit.
Oh, I'm sorry, Arthur. Did you hear that?
What was that?
Sorry, the wind blowing the shutter. Oh, come on, let's play. Throw a card, Arthur.
There's someone at the door.
It isn't the wind. Someone's outside.
All right, I'll open the door.
No, don't open it.
Please, Lucille. Sitting here frightened isn't going to do us any good. We've got to open the door.
Don't open it, Carl.
Who is it, Carl?
What? It's nothing. It's just the wind.
You're lying. Your face is white as a sheet.
I know. It's a skull. It's come back. I tell you, it's nothing. It's just the wind. Nobody was there.
I'll see for myself. The skull.
Oh, Mrs. Cruz, I didn't hear you knock.
I didn't. I want to talk to you, Spears.
Yes, Mrs. Cruz, but it's rather late.
You've been up late before.
Oh, yes, but it's just that I'm tired tonight. I don't mean to be rude.
You've been doing a lot of night work?
What are you referring to, Mrs. Cruz?
Spears, you don't really believe in skulls that move around by themselves, do you?
Well, I warned your husband about it. It's a curse.
Is it part of a curse for a skull to use a trowel to unbury itself? Your trowel?
My trowel? Oh, you're mistaken.
No, I'm not. I just came from there.
Why would I want to do anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Why? Why I'm here. I'd like to know why.
Please, Mrs. Cruz, I'm tired. We'll talk about it in the morning.
We'll talk about it now, Spears, right now.
Get out of my room.
All right. I'm going straight to the police. I've got the trowel. We'll see if the skull left any fingerprints.
You won't do that, Mrs. Cruz.
Oh, yes, I will. All right, Spears, just sit right where you are. I'll shoot.
Oh, please. Put the gun down.
Start talking.
Well, it's all a mistake.
If you don't start talking, I'll shoot. In self-defense. Did you dig up that skull?
Well,
Did you?
Yes. Yes, I did.
And you rolled the skull down the steps. The first night it was in this house, didn't you?
Well, it was only a joke.
And you also managed to open the closet.
Yes, but I...
Whose skull is it?
I don't know.
You're lying. That skull has something to do with you. I checked up on it. Your first wife disappeared. Perhaps the police can identify the skull.
Oh, please, don't go to the police. It was my first wife, Jane. I killed her. I didn't want your husband to bring the skull to the police. So I tried to scare all of you away from here as the safest measure.
Go on.
Yes. Wait a minute. Who rolled the skull into Arthur's room? It wasn't me. It must
have
been...
That's right. Was me. That's you and I can work things out. I tried to frighten my dear brother-in-law Arthur away so that I can have complete ownership of the entire estate. You see, Arthur is leaving tonight.
Yeah. Perhaps we can help each other. No one has to know of our little conversation.
No one is going to know.
Well, now that we've both accomplished our purpose, maybe it would be the best thing to bury the skull again.
Yes. We'll do it now.
Well, here we are.
Let's hurry. They'll miss me if I'm out here too long.
Perhaps we'd better dig another hole.
It doesn't matter.
Will you hold the skull?
No, but not.
You haven't suddenly gotten squeamish, have you, Mrs. Cruz?
Put the skull in the ground and dig that hole.
What's the matter?
The skull. Look at it.
But what about it?
Smooth, can't you see?
Well, it's just the wind pushing it.
Hurry up.
There. Yes, there. It's deep enough now. Hand me the skull. Oh, I forgot you won't touch it. All right, I'll get it myself.
What's the matter?
My hand. I can't get my hand out. The jaws. Clamp down.
Your hand,
please. Help me. You've got to help me. Do something. You've got to do something. You've got to let go.
Oh,
please, Jane. Jane, darling. I didn't mean to kill you.
know my wife. I didn't mean it. It was an accident. Please believe me. I'd do anything. Anything. Oh, no. No, Jane.
How is she, Carl?
Pretty bad. The doc says it's hopeless. Nothing more I can do. Her hair turned completely white. She's out of her mind. Spears died this morning. He never recovered consciousness. Died of fright.
Everything else seems to make sense, but I don't understand how the skull could have clamped its jaws on his hand.
When he picked it up, he must have picked it up upside down. The lower jaw, which swings on a hinge, came down. He was so frightened that his hand froze to the skull. Spears was just frightened to death.
I want that skull. Yes, sir, I want it as a knocker for the inner sanctum door. Good night. Pleasant dreams.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit www.LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. Recorded by Glenn Hallstrom, a.k.a. Smokestack Jones. SmokestackJones@gmail.com. Nyarlathotep by H.P. Lovecraft. Nyarlathotep. The crawling chaos. I am the last. I will tell the audience void. I do not recall distinctly when it began, but it was months ago. The general tension was horrible. To a season of political and social upheaval was added a strange and brooding apprehension of hideous physical danger, a danger widespread and all-embracing, such a danger as may be imagined only in the most terrible phantasms of the night. I recall that the people went about with pale and worried faces and whispered warnings and prophecies which no one dared consciously repeat or acknowledge to himself that he had heard. A sense of monstrous guilt was upon the land, and out of the abysses between the stars swept chill currents that made men shiver in dark and lonely places. There was a demonic alteration in the sequence of the seasons. The autumn heat lingered fearsomely, and everyone felt that the world and perhaps the universe had passed from control of known gods or forces to that of gods or forces which were unknown. And it was then that Nyarlathotep came out of Egypt. Who he was, no one could tell, but he was of the old native blood and looked like a pharaoh. The Philaean knelt when they saw him, yet could not say why. He said he had risen up out of the blackness of 27 centuries, and that he had heard messages from places not on this planet. Into the lands of civilization came Nyarlathotep, swarthy, slender, and sinister, always buying strange instruments of glass and metal, and combining them into instruments yet stranger. He spoke much of the sciences, of electricity and psychology, and gave exhibitions of power which sent his spectators away speechless, yet which swelled his fame to exceeding magnitude. Men advised one another to seek Nyarlathotep and shuddered, and where Nyarlathotep went, rest vanished. For the small hours were rent with the screams of nightmare. Never before had the screams of nightmare been such a public problem. Now the wise men almost wished they could forbid sleep in the small hours, that the shrieks of cities might less horribly disturb the pale, plying moon as it glimmered on green waters gliding under bridges and old steeples crumbling against a sickly sky. I remember when Nyarlathotep came to my city, the great, the old, the terrible city of unnumbered crimes. My friend had told me of him, and of the impelling fascination and allurement of his revelations, and I burned with eagerness to explore his uttermost mysteries. My friends said they were horrible and impressive beyond my most fevered imaginings. And what was thrown on the screen in the darkened room prophesied things none but Nyarlathotep dared prophesy, and that in the sputter of the sparks there was taken from man that which he had never been taken before, and which shewed only in his eyes. And I heard it hinted abroad that those who knew Nyarlathotep looked on sights which others saw not. It was in the hot autumn that I went through the night with the restless crowds to see Nyarlathotep, through the stifling night and up the endless stairs into the choking room. And shadowed on a screen I saw hooded forms amidst ruins, and yellow evil faces peering from behind fallen monuments. And I saw the world battling against blackness, against the waves of destruction from ultimate space, whirling, churning, struggling around the dimming, cooling sun. Then the sparks played amazingly around the heads of the spectators, and hair stood up on end, whilst shadows, more grotesque than I can tell, came out and squatted on their heads. And when I, who was colder and more scientific than the rest, mumbled a trembling protest about imposture and static electricity, Nyarlathotep drave us all out, down the dizzy stairs into the damp, hot, deserted midnight streets. I screamed aloud that I was not afraid, that I could never be afraid, and others screamed with me for solace. We swear to one another that the city was exactly the same, and still alive, and when the electric lights began to fade, we cursed the company over and over again, and laughed at the queer faces we made. I believe we felt something coming down from the greenish moon, for when we began to depend on its light, we drifted into curious involuntary formations, and seemed to know our destinations, though we dared not think of them. Once we looked at the pavement and found the blocks loose and displaced by grass, with scarce a line of rusted metal to shew where the tramways had run. And again we saw a tramcar, lone, windowless, dilapidated, and almost on its side. When we gazed around the horizon, we could not find the third tower by the river, and noticed that the silhouette of the second tower was ragged at the top. Then we split up into narrow columns, each of which seemed drawn in a different direction. One disappeared in a narrow alley to the left, leaving only the echo of a shocking moan. Another filed down a weed-choked subway entrance, howling with a laughter that was mad. My own column was sucked toward the open country, and presently felt a chill touch which was not of the hot autumn. For as we stalked out in the dark moor, we beheld around us the hellish moon-glitter of evil snows. Trackless, inexplicable snows, swept asunder in one direction only, where lay a gulf all the blacker for its glittering walls. The column seemed very thin indeed as it plodded dreamily into the gulf. I lingered behind, for the black rift in the green-litten snow was frightful, and I thought I had heard the reverberations of a disquieting wail as my companions vanished. But my power to linger was slight. As if beckoned by those who had gone before, I half-floated between the titanic snowdrifts, quivering and afraid into the sightless vortex of the unimaginable. Screamingly sentient, dumbly delirious, only the gods that were can tell. A sickened, sensitive shadow writing in hands that are not hands, and whirled blindly past ghastly midnights of rotting creation, corpses of dead worlds with sores that were cities, charnel winds that brush the pallid stars and make them flicker low. Beyond the worlds, vague ghosts and monstrous things, half-seen columns of unsanctified temples that rest on nameless rocks beneath space and reach up to dizzy vacua above the spheres of light and darkness. And through this revolting graveyard of the universe, the muffled, maddening beating of drums and thin, monotonous whine of blasphemous flutes from inconceivable, unlightened chambers beyond time, the detestable pounding and piping whereunto dance slowly, awkwardly and absurdly, the gigantic, tenebrous, ultimate gods, the blind, voiceless, mindless gargoyles whose soul is Nyarlathotep. The End of Nyarlathotep by H.P. Lovecraft.
Truth is stranger than Bill Ripley, believe it or not.
Officers in the Turkish Navy once were required to wear wooden replicas of their warships on their hats, believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you an odd way to live to a ripe old age.
Mayfield. Mayfield. Fresh new way to smoke. A fresh new kind of cigarette. Mayfield. The smoothest thing that's happened to smoking since the filter. Mayfield. With just enough menthol to smooth out the smoke, but not enough to blur the taste of the good tobaccos.
Sir John Robertson, 5 times Prime Minister of New South Wales, Australia, had a peculiar, but for him, successful way to enjoy a good long life. Every morning for 35 years, Sir John bought 3 pints of rum. This shopping tour was invariably accomplished on horseback. The Premier consumed 1 pint of rum on the spot, gave another pint to his and then to his riding boots as a preventive against rheumatism. Believe it or not.
Up next is a adaptation of a Ray Bradbury short story, The Rocket. It originally played on NBC Presents Short Story, another anthology series that offered dramatizations of contemporary American short stories by some of the very best writers of the time. They did adaptations of William Faulkner, Scott Fitzgerald and Shirley Jackson, Ernest Hemingway and others. It was not, however, a commercial success. It lasted only 1 year, that being the year of 1951 and part of 1952, and only about 25 stories survived. You know, and I've talked about this before, there's always a bit of tension between just running my mouth and having a good old time and realizing that sometimes the most earnest signal of approval of a work of art is to just get out of the way and let it go. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get out of the way and just let it go. This is really good.
NBC presents Short Story. Tonight, The Rocket by Ray Bradbury. Stories in the field of science fiction are usually associated in the public's mind with wildly fantastic juvenile adventures. Yet one of today's most promising young writers has seen fit to concentrate almost exclusively on science fiction material. He is Ray Bradbury, and his sensitive, moving stories have a universal appeal which stamps them as truly great. Listen now to a story of the future, Ray Bradbury's The Rocket. It spattered the concrete launching apron somewhere west of Kansas City. It climbed a fiery ladder and arched eastward over the sleeping land. Lovers looked upward and traced its path with drowsy fingers. The learned astronomers swore academic curses as the brilliant wake-fogged camera plates at Mount Wilson and Palomar and Harvard Observatory. The radar tracking units put their electronic heads together and came to the mathematical conclusion that Flight R-23 was on course at constant acceleration and would reach the orbit of Mars at its scheduled time. The 9 o'clock rocket was on its way.
Pirello. Fiorello, what are you doing up?
Nothing. Go to sleep.
What are you doing in your bare feet on the cold floor?
Nothing.
Come back to bed.
Later.
Later? 6 o'clock in the morning, you go to work at the junkyard. Don't be a fool. Come back to bed.
It woke me up.
What, the rocket? Well, that should be a law. All night, the rockets.
I'm going for a walk.
Now? 3 o'clock in the morning?
Leave me alone, my dear.
Oh, you're crazy. I know all the time. You think I'm asleep. You walk down by the river to that crazy Bramante who lives in the shack.
Please, Please don't spoil anything.
Spoil? I forbid it. By the right of a wife, I forbid it. Fiorello Bodoni, you come back to your bed.
Later. I'll be back later. Go to sleep, Murray.
I forbid it. I forbid it. At least take your overcoat.
Mars. The Venus.
Well, well, Bodoni.
Good evening, Bramante.
It is. Sit down.
The air is clear.
You come out for the air?
Small house smells of old food.
Only for the air?
Only the air.
I prefer the rockets myself. I was a boy when they started. I went to New Mexico to see the takeoff of the first one to the moon.
What was it like, the first rocket? Did it take off like these? Did it fly through the night on a fountain of fire?
I never saw it. A million other fools came for the same thing. I saw the pictures after. 65 years ago. And I've never ridden on one yet.
I'll ride up in one someday.
That fool, you'll never go. This is a rich man's world. Do we fly rockets? No. We live in shacks by the river like our ancestors before us.
Perhaps my sons.
No, nor their sons. It's the rich who have dreams and rockets. Who rides in that rocket? Bramante the laborer, but Bodoni the junk man? Ah.
Old man, I've saved $3,000. It took me 6 years to save it for my business, to invest in machinery. But every night for a month now...
You watch the rockets.
I hear them. I think. Tonight I've made up my mind. One of us will fly to Mars.
Idiot. How will you choose? Who will go? If you go, your wife will hate you. Or you will be just a bit nearer God in space. I can see the bitterness now.
No, not Maria.
And your children. Will their lives be filled with the memory of Papa who flew to Mars while they stayed here? They'll think of the rocket the rest of their lives, and they will be sick with wanting it, just as you are sick now. They'll want to die if they can't go.
I'm sick now.
Don't show them a goal in the stars, Bodoni. Turn their eyes down to their hands and to your junkyard, not up to the stars.
But
suppose your wife went. How would you feel, knowing she had seen and you had not? No, Bodoni. Buy a new wrecking machine, which you need, and pull your dreams apart with it and smash them to pieces. Listen to me, Bodoni.
There in the west. Look at it, Bramante. Climbing fire to the stars.
You haven't listened to me. Well, it gets cold.
Good night, Bramante.
Sleep well, Bodoni.
Fiorello Bodoni stood half-naked in darkness, watching the streaks of fire curve upward into the eternal night. And then he looked down. But the river before him reflected the flaming images of the rockets as they tore away from Earth. And there was no peace.
Fiorello?
It's all right.
Are you cold?
No, you should have slept.
I can get some hot milk.
I don't need it. Maria, I have $3,000.
Oh, in the morning.
No, now. I have enough to take one of us on the Mars rocket.
In the morning.
Monty says I should invest it in the business. Forget the rocket.
Fiorello, in the morning.
Think what you'd see. The meteors like fish, the universe, the moon.
What are you talking about, Fiorello?
You'd see the earth in the sky, Maria.
I would?
I only have money for one of us.
If someone is to go, it will be you. Now go to sleep.
Now, someone should go who could tell it well on returning. You have a way with words.
So have you.
Maria, it should be you.
Oh, in the morning, Fiorello. In the morning.
Hey, Papa. Papa, I saw the Venus rocket this morning.
Boy, oh boy.
Oh, that isn't the way the rocket goes. It goes zoom.
Children, listen, all of you.
I have enough money to take one of us on the Mars rocket.
Now, wait.
Only one of us, you understand? Who?
Me.
Listen, consider. Only one can go for the whole family. Consider, who should it be?
Papa, maybe Antonello.
Mary Omni. She's the girl.
You, Fiorello, you.
Here. Paolo, give me the broom.
The broom?
Here, now. I have straws here. All long but one. The short straw wins. Understand? We'll choose. Paolo, choose.
Yes, Papa.
What is it? What is it?
Long straw.
And Canelo?
Long straw, Papa.
All right, two straws left. You, Maria.
Oh, no, no.
Draw a straw.
I don't want to.
Draw.
Short straw.
Huh? Mama goes to Mars.
Yay, Mama!
Congratulations, I'll buy you a ticket today.
Congratulations, Mama.
You'll tell us all about Mars?
I'm glad it was you, Mama. Honest, I am.
I cannot go to Mars.
Why not?
I will be busy with another child.
What?
It wouldn't do for me to travel in my condition.
Is this the truth? Maria, is this true?
Yes, it's true. Draw again. Start over.
Why didn't you tell me this before?
We were talking about the rocket so much.
Maria.
Who goes, Papa?
Draw again. First, Paolo.
Papa, short straw. Papa, short straw. I go to Mars. I go to Mars.
That's swell.
I go to Mars, Papa. I can go, can't I?
Yes.
And you like me when I get back?
Of course.
Antonello, will you like me when I get back from Mars?
Sure. Sure, I guess.
Oh, Papa, I forgot. The school starts. I can't go. Draw again.
I couldn't go either, Papa. I'm awfully busy.
I am too, Papa.
None of us can go, Papa. Not alone. We wouldn't like each other after. No, none of us will go.
That's best.
Monty was right. Invest in junk.
Oh, never mind, Fiorello. Go on, eat your egg. You don't like it when it's cold.
Badoni!
Huh?
Badoni! Turn that thing off!
Huh?
Turn off the machine!
What do you want, Mr. Matthews?
I got some metal for you.
Big?
Plenty big.
What could it do me? My machinery's falling apart. 20 years old.
Now, quit kicking at something good.
What is it?
A rocket ship.
No.
What's the matter? Don't you want it?
Yes. Yes, I want it.
It's a mock-up, you know. When they plan a rocket, they build a full-scale model of aluminum. No engines. You might make a little profit boiling it down to the aluminum. I'll let you have it for $2,000.
I haven't got the money.
No? Oh, sorry. I thought I could help you. You said everybody outbid you on junk. I figured I could slip this to you on the QT. Well,
I need new equipment. I save money for that.
Oh, sure, sure. I understand.
Even if I bought your rocket, I wouldn't be able to melt it down. My aluminum furnace broke down last week.
Sure. Well, I see you.
I couldn't possibly use a rocket if I bought it from you.
Okay, sure.
But I'm a great fool. I'll take my money from the bank and give it to you.
If you can't melt it down, then...
Deliver it.
All right, if you say so. Tonight?
Tonight. Tonight would be fine. Yes, I'd like to have a rocket ship tonight.
Easy. Slack off. Oh, all right. Set it down. Look out. Easy. Oh. All right. Get the chains off her. Okay, Badoni, you got a rocket ship.
There was a moon. The rocket was white and big in the junkyard. It held the whiteness of the moon and the blueness of the stars.
Oh, my. Even if you never move a Spitfire and just sit there and rust for 50 years, you're mine.
The rocket smelled of time and distance. It was like walking into a clock. It was finished with Swiss delicacy. He crawled through the airlock and walked through the quiet of the passageway. The dome of the control room looked out over the river. The stars were overhead and the moon. He sat in the pilot's seat and touched a lever. The silence beat into his ears. His eyes were closed, and in his mind a hum began. Louder, 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 higher, wilder, stronger, trembling in him, leaning him forward and pulling him and the ship in roaring silence and in a kind of metal screaming, while his fists flew over the controls and his shut eyes quivered, and the sound grew and grew until it was a fire, a strength, a lifting and a pushing of power that threatened to tear him in half. He gasped. The hum was louder in his brain. On and on and on, his eyes tighter, his heart furious.
Taking off. Taking off.
A jolting concussion pounded in his brain, a thunder of power that was silenced to the ear. His eyes tight shut, he saw the flash of fiery rain in the sky.
The meteors!
It was a silent rush of still acceleration, the speed of the mind in the volcanic light of the sun. And with eyes tight, blind, seeing through the mind, he sped on to the great red disk hanging in a black velvet sky.
Mars! Mars! I see it! Mars!
He fell back, exhausted. His shaking hands came loose of the controls and his head tilted back wildly. He sat for a long time, breathing out and in, his heart slowing. Slowly, slowly, he opened his eyes. The junkyard was still there. He sat motionless. He looked at the heaped piles of rusting metal.
Take off. I'll show you. I'll show you. Frog squat in the junkyard. I'll show you. You're right. You won't. I'll show you. Now I'll show you. You'll feel it when a wrecking wave hit you. You'll listen to me when I smash you. This is my wrecking machine. I'm Fear of Adonia, and I'm gonna crack you, smash you up now! Now!
Silver rocket lay in the light of the moon. The long, slim shape poised in the piles of rusting junk seemed to be moving. The stubby fins seemed swept back by the winds, and the hull seemed crouched for the leap into the skies. Fedoni's hand was on the lever that would send the massive weights of his terrible wrecking machine plunging into the thin aluminum hull, cracking, ripping apart this insolent dream, this silly thing for which he had paid his money and which would not move. But his hand stayed. Beyond the rocket, a block away, stood the yellow lights of his house burning warmly. He stepped down from the wrecking machine. He went home, and when he came in the front door, he was laughing.
Maria.
Fiorello, the children are in bed.
But wait till we start packing. We're going to Mars. We're going to Mars.
You took our money for this?
We're going to Mars.
It will never fly.
It will fly. Children.
Papa, is it real?
Yes, it's real.
Can I touch it?
Later. Now go to the house, all of you. I have work to do. Tomorrow we leave. Tell no one. Tomorrow we leave. Tell no one. Understand? It's a secret.
Oh, you have ruined us. Our money used for this thing.
Please, Maria, you'll see.
Never. Fiorello Bodoni, you are a madman. Goodbye.
Where are you going?
To the house. Someone has to take care of your children.
God help me.
Through the midnight hours, trucks arrived, packages were delivered, and Bodoni, smiling, exhausted his bank account.
Hey, Mac, want to check this bill of lading? Ration, United Space Commissary, type 34-7, 10 cartons. Space precautionary repair clothing, one set, including a 34 glassine helmet, breather hold assembly, type 867, shoulder coupling assembly, rubber steel welded.
When the dawn light turned the dark, twisted shadows into piles of old plumbing fixtures and auto chassis, the sputter of Fiorello Bodoni's welding equipment crackled through the yard. A pile of crates stood by the rocket, the wood fresh, the stenciled writing spelling out in authorized standard abbreviations, the roadway to the stars.
Gee, look at that, Tony. Space rations. Guaranteed 7 acceleration rigging.
What's acceleration rigging?
Well, that's so you can take off without being mashed flat.
We're really going. Gee.
You kids, Paolo and Donello.
Hi, Papa.
you kids get away from the rockets.
We weren't touching anything.
You've got to be careful with rockets. High tension.
Sure, Papa. We thought maybe we could help.
Don't you worry. Your Papa's going to take care of everything.
Through the night, the giant arcs brought a lifeless day to the junkyard. The cold blue light was hard. The flash of sparks from the welding machine spurted out like a run of meteors hitting an atmosphere and flaring into nothingness. With welding torch, riveter, and soldering iron, Fiorello Bodoni assaulted the rocket, added, took away, worked fiery magics and secret insults upon it. He bolted 9 ancient automobile motors into the rocket's empty engine room. Then he welded the engine room shut so that none could see his hidden labor. And at morning, he came back to the house.
Maria, I'm ready for breakfast. No word for your husband? Never mind. I'm not hungry. I have more work to do.
The optical equipment was delivered, nested in foam rubber, spring-mounted against the tremor of a sharp-turned street corner, or the smashing jar of a planetfall. The electric wiring snaked through the shining corridors of the rocket like the thin, white, branching nerve from brain to spinal cord to muscle. And then the yard was still. The hammer was laid down. The pile of fresh wood crates was gone. The rocket leaned forward, jutting above the mounds of rusting bed springs and countless empty beer cans. At sunset, Fiorello Bodoni came into his house and called to the children.
Paolo, Antonello, Mariamne. Children.
They will not answer.
Why not?
I've locked them in the closet.
What do you mean?
You'll be killed in that rocket.
Listen to me, Maria.
It will blow up. Anyway, you're no pilot.
I can fly this ship. I fixed it.
You have gone mad.
Where's the key to the closet?
They will not go. Kill yourself. Leave me my children.
Where's the key?
I have it here.
Give it to me.
Oh, no.
Give it to me.
Leave the baby. Leave me the little girl.
No, all must go. Give me the key.
Oh, here. You will kill them.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, you will. I feel it.
You won't come along.
I will stay here.
You'll understand. You'll see then. Children, come out. Come, follow your father. We'll go to Mars. Come.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Maria. You'll see.
Murderer.
Children, before we go inside, listen carefully. We'll be gone a week. You must get back to school and I to my business. Listen. This rocket is very old and will fly only one more journey. It will not fly again. This will be the one trip of your life. Keep your eyes open wide.
Yes, Papa.
All right, we'll go inside. I'll lift you, Mariamne. Stand clear. I close the airlock. Ready now, children. We're going to Mars. Listen. Keep your ears clean. Smell the smells of a rocket. Feel. Remember, so when you return, you'll talk about all the rest of your lives. Do you understand, Paolo?
Yes, Papa.
Antonello?
Yes, Papa.
Mariamne?
Yes, Papa.
You mustn't loosen the straps of the rubber hammocks. Ready?
Ready.
And I'll throw the switches. Now we take off for Mars.
The children, strapped like tiny mummies in the rubber hammocks, screamed as the rocket thundered and leapt. They danced in the webbing, shouting and pointing 100 ways at once. And then in the port above them, a silver circle floated by, pockmarked with craters, the edge etched sharp against the velvet black.
The moon! That's the moon!
Look well, children. Remember.
The moon dreamed by, the black of space broken by the fierce pinpoints of the stars swarmed around them. And then a flight of fire, a shower of bright flame across the ports.
Meteors! Those are meteors! meteors, aren't they, Papa? Aren't they?
Those are meteors. Remember. Remember.
The hours enveloped them. Time flowed away in a serpentine of gas. The children shouted, their eyes wide, their ears filled with the...
What's that out of that green ball? What's that?
The Earth. The whole of Earth. Remember it, my little daughter. Remember how the ground you'll walk the rest of your life looks from where God sits.
The rocket dropped pink petals of fire while the hour dial spun. The child eyes dropped shut. At last, they hung like drunken moths in their cocoon hammocks.
Paolo. Antonello. Briomni. Good.
He tiptoed from the control room, down the shining corridors where the handholds stood out from the cold walls. And then, before the airlock, he stood a long time. Fearful, hesitating, he pressed a button. The airlock door swung open. The door that leads to space, into inky tides of meteor and gaseous torch, into swift mileages and infinite dimensions. Fiorello Bodoni smiled and stepped out. He stood outside the door, and all around the quivering rocket lay the junkyard, rusting, unchanged. There stood the padlocked junkyard gate, the little silent house by the river, the kitchen window lighted. And in the center of the junkyard, manufacturing a magic dream, lay the quivering, purring rocket, shaking and roaring, bouncing the netted children like flies in a web.
Maria, Maria.
Fiorello.
It goes well. I must get back now. God, God, let nothing happen for 6 days. Let nothing happen to the illusion. Let all of space come and go and red Mars come up under our ship and the moons of Mars. Let there be no flaw in the color film. Let there be three dimensions. Let nothing go wrong with the mirrors and screens that mold the fine illusion. Let time pass. God, let us make our trip to Mars.
When the children awoke, red Mars floated near the rocket. Bodoni looked and saw red Mars, and it was good, and there was no flaw in it, and he was very happy. At sunset on the seventh day, Fiorello Bodoni sat before the giant panel and threw 10 switches, and the rocket stilled.
All right, children, we're home.
Sit down. I have ham and eggs for all of you.
Mama, you should have seen it.
Mars, Mama, and the meteors.
And the moon, Mama, you should have seen the moon.
Oh, yes. Now eat, all of you. The eggs are hot.
Papa, we want to thank you.
It was nothing.
We'll remember it for always, Papa. We saw the moon and the meteors. We rode on a rocket to Mars. We'll never forget.
Eat now. The eggs will get cold.
Fiorello, are you awake?
Yes.
You're the best father in the world.
Why?
Now I see. Now I understand. Is it a very lovely journey?
Yes.
To Mars?
To Mars.
Fiorello?
Yes?
Maybe some night you might take me on just a little trip. Do you think?
Just a little one, maybe.
Oh, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
You have heard The Rocket by Ray Bradbury. Our radio adaptation was by Ernest Canoy. In tonight's cast, the narrator was Stanley Waxman, Maria Margaret Brayton, Bodoni Don Diamond, Bramante Ralph Moody,
Paolo, Joel Nestler. Antonello, David Duval. Miriamne, Dorothy Brown. Matthews, Kurt Martell. Your announcer, John Wald. The director of NBC Presents Short Story is Andrew C. Love.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've made it. Well, made it to the last break anyway. But I can promise this really is the last break. Macabre was a radio show produced by and for the Far Eastern Network of the Armed Forces Radio. Macabre's production facilities were all in Japan, Tokyo to be exact, and everyone who worked on it, performers to engineers to sound crew, were all Air Force personnel. It began its run on November the 13th of 1961 and would run until January 8th of 1962. It actually arose out of a competition between the Far East Network and the Armed Forces Radio in Germany. And the result of this is that the Tokyo cast and crew produced what most of us regard as a very well-done show for almost no money. There's not a lot of information in circulation about this show, really. I do know that they only produced 8 shows, or at least only 8 shows are still in circulation. Anyway, from January the 1st of 1962, we have The Crystalline Man.
Man lives in a world of time and space. He lives in a spectrum of the universe. When he ventures beyond this limit, he is in the unknown, a realm where strange forces are brought into play. When man attempts to misuse these forces, he is sometimes destroyed. This is Macabre.
The Far East Network presents, in special performance, Macabre. Tonight's story, The Crystalline Man.
Hello?
Hello. Is this Dr. Vega?
Yes.
This is Thomas Paine of the National Museum. I'm calling for Professor Abernathy. We've been trying to reach you for a week.
I've been out of town. Gone.
It's about the expedition to the glacier.
Oh, what, have they returned?
Well, yes. Unexpectedly.
Did they find anything?
Not exactly. You see, Professor Norden...
Come. What about Professor Norden?
He did not come back.
What?
The members of the expedition are meeting tonight at the museum. Can you attend?
Certainly, Mr. Paine. What time?
8:00. And may I ask you, sir, not to fail us?
Of course I won't. But what's happened to Norden?
At the moment, sir, I cannot say. We'll expect you then at 8:00. What we have to report is of the utmost urgency.
Now, gentlemen, a simple expedition to the Arctic, and you come back whimpering like children. Now, really, what do you expect me to think, Professor Abernathy?
Please be seated, Dr. Vega. Thank God you come. You know Thomas Paine of the museum?
Yes, he telephoned me.
And my associate, Craig Taylor.
How do you do, Mr. Taylor?
Good evening, Doctor.
Now, what happened to Norden?
It's hard to explain.
Professor, either he came back or he didn't. Which was it?
He did not.
That thing in the other room.
Not yet, Paine.
Thing? What thing?
Before you see it, Doctor, it'll take explanation.
What do you think? I am a child? You believe I'm too naive to know the facts? Let me refresh you. I backed your expedition. My father disappeared in those wilds 5 years ago and was never found. Professor Norton thought he knew the route, that he could find some trace, but you return without him cowering like a pack of whiff puppies. Now, speak up, gentlemen. What happened?
Have patience with us, Dr. Vega. We have stumbled upon something we do not understand. Something that has cost the life of Professor Norton and may not stop there.
Well, go ahead. Tell me the full story.
We had camped for the night on the glacier. The next morning, we noticed a fissure in the ice. A passageway large enough for a man to crawl through. In the ice, we could see the frozen body of a dog. It wasn't one of ours. I thought it might have been one of your father's. Norton decided to crawl into the fissure to investigate. Taylor remained with me. A storm came up suddenly, and we called out to Norton in the passageway. Professor Norton, have you found any trace? Professor!
What do you make of Craig?
He's been in there 15 minutes. Do you think he's all right?
I don't know. We haven't heard from him since he left us. With a storm blowing, a fissure isn't exactly a safe place to be.
Danger of an avalanche. Better warn him. Professor Norton! There's a storm! Let's get out of here!
No answer.
Got a flashlight? It's dark in there.
Yes.
Come on, we better look for him.
Fissure doesn't appear too old.
No, perhaps only a few days old. Otherwise, there'd be a heavy layer of snow on the bottom. I hope that ice overhead is solid. Any kind of slide would bury us.
Pitch black now. I didn't realize the passage was this deep.
What's that ahead?
Huh?
It's like a rock where the glacier meets the mountainside.
Two more feet and we'll be there.
Why, it looks like the entrance of a cave. Norton must be inside.
Certainly took a chance going this far by himself. Shall we go in?
We have no choice. Look, it's not a natural cave.
You're right. The entrance is a carved arch. Solid quartz. Do you recognize the symbols?
I've never seen anything like this before. Where to find Craig, and by coincidence, too. If that fissure in the ice hadn't opened here, it might have been lost forever.
How old would you guess it is?
Impossible to tell. We've got to find Norton. Hand me the light. I'll go first. Professor Norton! Professor!
Looks like an ancient crypt. Tarnished urns, ornate carving.
Unhealthy atmosphere, Craig. I don't know what we've stumbled on, but for the past I know nothing about. Where could Norton have gone?
Seems to be the only room. He's got to be here.
I'll move the light around once again, slowly.
A man just doesn't disappear in thin air.
What's that?
Where?
Pile of rubble. Something caved in.
Yes, in the corner. Come on. It's Norton. He's alive.
Quick, clear the rocks. He's caught in the slide. Professor Norton, can you hear me?
Yes. I'm done for, Abernathy. You and Craig, get out of here as fast as you can.
Nonsense. We'll have you free in a moment.
There's another room behind those rocks.
Don't go in there. I moved some rocks to cover the doorway. Slide buried me.
Did you find a trace of Dr. Vega's father?
No. Just cover that doorway and leave. Norton!
Poor devil. He's gone.
Strange.
What's that?
I'm not a medical doctor. But he doesn't seem to have been fatally injured by the cave-in.
What do you mean?
The answer may lie in there.
He was probably delirious.
We'd better get out of here. But before we do, shouldn't we have a look?
Norton warned us.
Would a scientist refuse?
After you, Professor.
Careful, Craig. Don't upset that boulder. It could stop all our plans.
Ease under that arch. We don't know how old this is. It may crumble.
Why, it's just a room, like the other.
Look, straight ahead. At the foot of that altar.
Yes. Sparkles like a jewel.
That's what Norton warned us about.
Nonsense. We're scientists, Craig.
Norton was no fool.
Neither am I. Let's have a closer look. A 10-foot jewel. A prize from the Arabian Nights.
Or a quartz sarcophagus.
Of course. Why was Norton afraid of it? It's not locked. The lid can be raised.
No, Professor.
My boy, this is what every scientist dreams of. How can you refuse?
All right. I can't tell why. Something seems to be warning me to leave this alone. If you have to, take a look. Let's get out of here.
Harry, give me a hand.
Okay.
What was it? What did you find in the sarcophagus, Professor Abernathy?
Will you follow us, please, Dr. Vega?
Wait. It might be better to destroy it.
Mr. Taylor, you can't do that.
Yes, I know. the museum.
You might remember we have financed your exploits for many years. There is some sort of obligation to us, don't you think?
Pardon me. I had forgotten the commercial aspects.
The public has a right to see these remnants of mankind's past.
Gentlemen, will you follow me, please? Frankly, we are at a loss to make it out. It is entirely beyond the range of my experience. In the center of the room, if you will.
The quartz sarcophagus.
Well, what are we waiting for? Open it.
I hope we don't regret this.
Help me, Craig.
Okay.
There it is, Dr. Vega.
This is incredible. Is it some kind of joke?
We wish it were, Doctor.
Man. A crystalline man, perfect in detail, even to his thumbprints. It's fantastic. What do you think, Mr. Payne?
I haven't had a great deal of time to research it. However, I can't link him to any period of recorded history. He is not prehistoric, as he resembles modern man. His clothing is well-tailored, though of a design I've never seen. He looks 45, intelligent and scholarly. He doesn't have the appearance of death. The strange part is, instead of flesh and blood, he seems to be pure crystal.
Is it possible the man could once have lived? And if he could, what forgotten tongue lost in the antiquity of time would he speak?
We may know tomorrow.
How do you mean?
I believe that by some process unknown to us today, this man is still alive. It's no use. We've tried everything. He is solid crystal. I was mistaken.
He is perfect to the last blood vessel.
Why should a man who is not flesh and blood need blood vessels?
Shall we admit he is merely a sculptured statue?
We don't seem able to prove otherwise, but I feel some obvious fact is escaping us.
Wait. There is one further chance. He may be a silicon form of life. In that case, he should respond to electric shock, be recharged, so to speak. Let me connect these electrodes.
Any sign of life will show in the form of a brain wave on the electroencephalogram. Good thinking, Professor.
There. Now we'll give him a jolt.
Nothing. Try it again. Not a thing.
Look, an eyelid moved.
No, Payne, you're mistaken. Nothing moved.
Professor, did you see?
No. If he's alive, it's in a form unknown to us.
What will you do with him?
You finance the expedition, Dr. Vega. You call it.
But, gentlemen, the museum...
Mr. Payne, can't you forget that place? Does every scientific discovery have to go on display like a bargain in Gimbel's basement?
Well, I only assumed the body would have to be disposed of somewhere.
Are you sure you want it, Mr. Payne, after Norden's warning?
What happened to Professor Norden had nothing to do with the crystalline man. He was probably delirious when you found him.
All right, enough. The truth of this still escapes us. However, it can serve no purpose by remaining here.
We may have it.
You may regret it, Payne, but go ahead. Take it. Put it on display in the slumber room. That may well be what he's doing.
Very well. We'll exhibit it in the public interest, with the provision that you retain the right to examine it when you choose.
Oh, Professor,
I just left the coroner's office. Too bad.
The coroner's office?
The guard we found unconscious here this morning. The one guarding the crystalline man last night.
Yes?
He just died. Two of The Crystalline Man will be heard in a moment. But first...
What causes traffic accidents? Weather conditions? Road conditions? Vehicle conditions? These all have some part in the total traffic picture, but it's the driver's own conditions, both mental and physical, that cause a great many of the accidents that you read and hear about day by day. You may find somewhere in the accident report that the driver in an accident was tired, angry, inattentive, or had been drinking. Harder to find in the report would be the driver's mental state at the time of the accident. In many cases, the driver didn't know, didn't think, or didn't care about the possibility of having an accident. How can he be made more aware of the danger he is causing to himself and everyone else? The National Safety Council suggests one good way is by an active community campaign against such thinking. And that's where you come in. Our community and our local safety organizations need your active support. Let's all accept our responsibility to join the fight for life and help save lives.
And now, Act Two of The Crystalline Man. Man, you kids eat like horses. It's a good thing your father makes a little money. Takes it all just to feed you.
Craig, now stop it. When you were their age, you had some life in you, too.
There's plenty of life left in this old boy, Mary.
Hey, Dad, when you quit laughing, can I ask you a question?
Go ahead, Jimmy. Try me.
After supper, can I go over to Ralph's a while?
And can I go too, Daddy?
Now, wait a minute. Both of you? What's going on?
Ralph's got a new turtle.
You children run along, but don't be out late.
Oh, boy. Come on, let's go.
Jimmy, you and Christine be careful and come home before dark.
Sure thing. Bye, Dad.
We will. Bye, Daddy.
Wow, a couple of wild Indians. Reminds me how old I'm getting.
Oh, darling, they're just little children.
I wish I could be carefree like that.
Craig, things are different, aren't they?
Oh? How?
Something's bothering you.
You're imagining it.
No. Ever since that last trip, you all seem worried. How long has it been in the museum?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. And two more.
Don't go on, Mary. The police said Mrs. Locks died from natural causes. She was found the next morning by her pail and mop in the Egyptian room.
And what about Gus?
Faithful old Gus. Best night watchman we ever had.
I know. He was old and ready to retire. But don't you think something got him, too? He was found like Mrs. Locks, dead the next morning.
Mary, you...
There's talk now, Craig. Before long, people will be afraid to go to the museum. If the police find any connection between those deaths and this crystalline man, you'll all be in trouble.
It's against any kind of logic to think that.
Darling, you've said so yourself. There are many things in this world we don't understand. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It means at the moment we haven't the capacity for understanding.
We've uncovered the genius of some civilization long past. If the man is not a statue, he certainly isn't a corpse, then he was preserved for a reason. Professor Norden suspected right away. He was trying to wall up the crypt so he wouldn't find him when he was fatally injured. Now the crystalline man lies in the museum like some Trojan horse, harboring God knows what menace from the dawn of time. I'm sorry, Mary. It had to come out.
I'm glad you said it, darling.
We should have destroyed him. We couldn't bring ourselves to do it. He's so lifelike. It would have seemed like murder.
You can't let things like this continue. The police have nothing to go on. But you know what's wrong. You can stop him.
All I have is a feeling, a suspicion. I promise you, Mary.
What, darling?
If there's another death, I'll take it on myself to find out what's wrong with the crystalline man.
Here's the night watchman. You want to ask him, Christine?
No, you ask.
Oh, all right. Mister?
Eh? Museum's closed. You kids go away.
I gotta ask you something.
Run along now. It'll be dark soon. You ought to be home.
Please, mister. We have to go inside.
Oh, do you now?
You tell him, Christine.
Okay, Jimmy. We were here after school today. I left my homework in there.
Museum's locked up. Come back tomorrow. Your books will be turned into the main office. You can pick them up then.
But you don't understand.
She has to study her homework tonight. Don't you see?
Or I'll get a spanking.
Do your parents know where you are?
Gosh, no.
They think we're at Ralph's seeing a turtle.
You said that so I could get my homework. Please, mister.
Well, you should be more careful.
You don't want us to get spanked, do you?
I'm not supposed to let anybody in. I might lose my job. Regulations, you know.
It'll be a secret just between us. We won't tell anyone.
Yeah, a secret.
Okay. Just between us, then. But remember, no tricks. Whisk in, pick up homework, whisk out. Just like that. Check.
Check.
Know where he left it, Christine?
Yes, on the table by the dinosaur.
It's pretty dark. Can you see your way?
I think so. Be right back.
What's your last name, son?
Taylor.
What? Your father is Craig Taylor?
Sure.
Professor Abernathy's associate. I knew it. Now I will be in trouble.
Don't worry. We won't tell him.
Some days you can't win. Christine, hurry up.
Let me go in. I'll find her.
Yes. Good idea. Quick, get your sister. Hurry up, son. I don't want any trouble. Now I've done it. When the professor finds I've broken regulations, I'll be out of me job. That's funny. Those kids are taking a long time. Christine! Jimmy! Make it snappy! Hope nobody comes along the street and sees me here with this door open. Oh, goodbye, job. Hey, those two ought to be back. I don't hear a peep out of them. Getting too dark in there to make much out.
Hey, Christine! Jimmy!
Uh-oh. I don't like this.
Hey, in there! You kids all right?
Who was she, Craig?
Edna Thorpe, a cleaning woman.
Please, Mr. Taylor, I hope there won't be no trouble about me letting the kids in. How did I know they'd find old Mrs. Thorpe dead?
Natural causes again, Craig?
Police coroner said heart attack. Christine, you're sure the dead woman was the only thing you saw?
Yes, Daddy. I just signed my homework when I saw her. Then Jimmy came in.
We were too scared to move, Dad.
Uh-huh.
What are you going to do?
Mary, you can see what we're facing here. Take the children home. I'll be along later.
But, Craig, aren't you coming with us?
No, I'm spending the night in the museum. It's time we learn the truth.
Not alone, darling. That's too dangerous.
The deaths occur only when there are no witnesses. The only way to find out is to bait the hook. I'll stay in there alone tonight. The killer may be tempted to strike again. And then we'll know. Ten past two. Getting sleepy. Big place. Those two dinosaurs aren't kittens. Egyptian mummies back in the east wing. Caveman relics. And the crystalline man in the slumber room. He's a standout, all right. Attracts the crowds in the jewel sarcophagus. There he is. Almost in a standing position. Sarcophagus tilted back so he can't fall out. 6 feet of complete mystery. A man of the world, but not of this world. Question is he statue or is he real? I think Norton knew. Too bad he couldn't have told us more. Strange thing is that in this collection of relics of the past, he alone doesn't reflect some state of decomposition. The key lies there, I'm sure of it. But logic tells me our killer is flesh and blood. Wish they turned on more light at night. Oh, sorry I sent everyone away. The place has an eerie, uncomfortable feeling. Where's that chair I saw around here? Oh, there it is. Feels good to sit down. I don't think it'll hurt to close my eyes for a moment. I've been over every inch of this place. Safe enough, I guess. Could be coincidence. Those people who died, all old, including Norton. Oh, boy, I'm getting sleepy. Maybe a little catnap wouldn't hurt. Just a little whimper. Was it?
Shadow standing over me. How could anyone have come here? Can't see in the dark. Something is going to hit me, but...
Stop! Who are you? Crystalline man.
When I touch thee, breathe deeply, savage, and thou wilt be gone.
Wait! Then you are alive.
Since the beginning of time.
How old are you?
Perhaps a million of 5 years.
But modern man doesn't go back that far.
Be
Who are you?
We are also men of science. Perhaps we can get together.
Savage, 5 millions. We are eternity apart.
Why haven't you risen before?
This form of life is like a battery. It must be charged.
I see. But the life force of others.
Thou speakest well, Savage.
So that's what Norton knew. Revive him and there'll be no stopping him.
Thou knowest too much, Savage. What is thy saying? To the victor goes the spoil. I will touch thee, and thou wilt be gone.
No!
Stand still. It will be painless. Just a touch, and I will be of strength to begin my work.
Don't come any closer.
Fear me not, Savage.
I'm warning you.
Where can thou escape? The wall is behind, and I am before thee.
Keep away from me.
Now, Savage, I shall smite thee to death.
That scream, high enough to shatter crystal. You saved my life. Look, the man of a million years at our feet in a million pieces.
Just heard Macabre, a special Far East Network presentation. Tonight's story was The Crystalline Man. In our cast were John Buey, Milton Radmilovich, Walt Sheldon, Army PFC Alan Frank, William Verdier, Mitzi Hennessy, Christine Verdier, James Sheldon, Air Force Sergeant Al LePage. Associate Director was Carolyn Johnston. Technical supervision by Hiroshi Ono. With special sound patterns by Airman First Class James Conley and Air Force Sergeant Bob Eddy. This is Air Force Sergeant Al LePage speaking. Macabre was written and directed by William Verdier.
Macabre comes to you each week at this time through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
That's it. This is another Night Transmissions in the can. Oh, by the way, you should go to the website, nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions, just one word. And on that page you'll find information about everything that was on the show. Well, nearly everything. Usually everything. Oh, and I don't mention this often enough. There's a phone number. A G-voice phone number. The odds of you getting through to me or any human being are rather remote. But it is a good place to leave messages. And I like it when that happens. The Google Voice number is 541-995-0594. Give us a call. In any case, just a thought. See ya.